Pull up a chair. This one starts with a smell: old engine oil, hot metal, and salt. So much salt that it soaks into everything, into the wicker seats, into the fabric on the wings, into the crew's wool jackets, until they crackle when they bend their arms. That's what it smelled like inside a blue Fokker trimotor somewhere over the middle of the Pacific Ocean in the summer of 1928. And nobody had ever smelled it before. Not up there, not that far out. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar, where we sit and swap stories about the people who flew before us. Today I want to take you across the biggest stretch of open water on this planet, in an airplane held together with wood, wire, and nerve. Let me tell you about a little Australian who most Americans have never heard of. His name was Charles Kingsford Smith, and I think that's a shame we ought to fix. Before we get into it, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and that's really what we do here, isn't it? Check them out at AviationSold.com now. Let me set the scene. The 1920s were the great age of the impossible flight. Lindbergh had crossed the Atlantic solo in 1927, and every pilot with fuel and a dream started looking at the map for the next blank space. The next thing nobody had done. And there it was, the Pacific. Not the narrow neck of the Atlantic that Lindbergh crossed. The Pacific from California to Australia is better than 7,000 miles of water, and back then there was nothing out there, no radar, no satellites, no long-range radio you could count on. Just a handful of specks of coral and a whole lot of ocean that did not care whether you lived or died. Men had tried, men had gone out over that water and simply never come back. No wreckage, no signal, just gone, swallowed whole. Kingsford Smith looked at that and said, "That's the one." Now here's where it gets interesting. Smithy. Everybody called him Smithy. He was not some gentleman adventurer with a trust fund. He'd flown in the Great War with the Royal Flying Corps, got shot up over France, lost part of his foot. He came home and he flew anything that would fly, barnstorming. Airmail, joyrides for a few shillings. He knew airplanes the way you know an old friend, by the sound they make when something's about to go wrong. He had a partner, another Aussie named Charles Ulm, a sharp organizer, the man who could talk money out of a stone, and they needed money because the airplane they wanted was not cheap. They found her in the United States, a Fokker F7 trimotor, high wing, one thick wooden wing built like a barn beam, no struts, just this great cantilever plank of spruce and plywood, stretched out over the fuselage. Three air-cooled Wright Whirlwind engines, same kind of engine that carried Lindbergh across the Atlantic. One in the nose, one on each wing, they painted her blue and they gave her a name, the Southern Cross. After the constellation you see in the southern sky, the one that points the way home if you're below the equator and you know how to read it. Getting to the starting line nearly killed the whole dream. The money ran out. Backers pulled out. At one point, Smithy and Ulm were flat broke in California, their airplane sitting there, and it took a wealthy Californian, a man named Alan Hancock, to step in and buy the aircraft outright and hand it back to them so they could make the attempt. That kind of faith in two foreigners with a wild idea. Aviation has always run on that. They rounded out the crew with two Americans. Harry Leon, the navigator, an old sea captain who could find a rock in the ocean with a sextant and a watch, and James Warner, the radio operator, the man who would sit in the roar and try to pull a human voice out of the static. Four men, one airplane, three legs across the Pacific. Here's the thing about how they flew it, and I want you student pilots listening to really sit with this, because it'll make your cross-country planning feel like a walk to the mailbox. They could not fly it all at once. No airplane then could carry that much fuel. So they broke it into hops. California to Hawaii, Hawaii to Fiji, Fiji to Australia, and the middle leg, Hawaii to Fiji. That was the killer. Better than 3,000 miles, the longest open water flight anyone had ever attempted. There was no island in between big enough to matter. If an engine quit out there, you came down in the sea, and the sea kept what it took. They left Oakland, California on the last day of May, 1928, heavy. So heavy with fuel that the Southern Cross staggered off the runway and clawed for altitude like she resented every pound of it. That first leg to Hawaii went about as well as any of it went. 27 hours over the water, they landed, refueled, rested, and stared down the barrel of the big one. Now picture the cockpit. And I mean really picture it, because it is nothing like what you know. It is loud. It is so loud you cannot speak. Those three whirlwinds are screaming on either side and in front of you, and the noise gets inside your skull and lives there. Smithy and Ulm sat up front at the controls, behind them. Down in the belly of the fuselage among the fuel tanks, Leon the navigator and Warner the radio man worked in a space so cramped they could barely turn around. They talked to each other by passing notes, scribbled on a pad, handed forward, because the human voice meant nothing in that racket. There was no autopilot. None. That means for the entire crossing, one of those two men up front had his hands on the controls every single second hand, flying in cloud, in rain, at night. For more than 30 hours straight on the long leg, your arms turn to lead, your eyes play tricks. The instruments in front of you are primitive, a turn indicator, an altimeter, a compass swinging around in the turbulence, and you're betting four lives that you can keep the greasy side down when you cannot see the horizon, and your own body is lying to you about which way is up. And then the Pacific showed them its teeth. On that middle leg, they flew into weather that would put a knot in your stomach today. In a modern airplane with radar painting the cells, they had none of that. They flew straight into towering tropical storms, the kind that build up over warm ocean into black walls of water and lightning. The Southern Cross got tossed around like a leaf in a gutter. Rain came through every seam. The men were soaked and freezing at altitude and roasting down low, and the airplane groaned through it, that big wooden wing flexing, and they just held on and kept the nose pointed at a spot on the ocean they could not see, thousands of miles away, that they had to hit or die. Lion, the navigator. This is the part that gets me, old sea captain. He's down in the back doing dead reckoning and celestial navigation. When the clouds broke, he'd shoot the stars with a sextant, work the math by hand, and tell Smithy to come left 2 degrees or hold your heading. 2 degrees over 3,000 miles of empty ocean. Aiming for an island group you could cover with your thumb. Get the arithmetic wrong. Get the wind wrong. And you fly right past land into nothing, and you run the tanks dry, and you go into the water, and that is the end of the story, and nobody ever knows what happened to you. He didn't get it wrong. After more than 34 hours in the air on that single leg, 34 hours of hand flying and storms, and note passing and salt and cold and roar. The island of Fiji came up out of the sea right where Harry Lyon said it would be. Let that sink in. No GPS, no moving map, no second engine reliability you'd trust today. A man with a sextant and a pencil found a dot in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. They put her down at Suva on a little cricket ground because there was no real airfield, cleared just barely long enough. The crowd had never seen an airplane before. Some of them ran from it.
One leg left. Fiji to Brisbane. More storms. The worst yet. Some of the crew later said it was the roughest flying of the whole trip, right at the end when they were used up and running on nothing. But on the 9th of June 1928, the Southern Cross came out of the clouds over Brisbane, Australia, and there were 15,000 people waiting. Some accounts say more. A whole nation had been holding its breath, following it in the newspapers, and when that blue Fokker touched down, the place came apart. Grown men crying. Smithy, the barnstormer, the kid who'd lost part of his foot in the war, had just done the thing that could not be done. First flight across the Pacific Ocean. Now I could stop there and it'd be a good story, but here's what I want you to carry out of the hangar today. Smithy didn't stop. That was the thing about him. The Southern Cross became the most famous airplane in the Southern Hemisphere, and he kept flying her into the history books. First nonstop crossing of the Australian continent. First flight across the Tasman Sea to New Zealand and back, which is its own stretch of nasty cold water that has killed plenty. And then in 1930, he flew her east to west across the Atlantic, and eventually all the way around the world, that one airplane. That same blue Fokker. He was knighted, Sir Charles Kingsford Smith, and still he flew, because that's what he was. He was a pilot down to the bone, and pilots fly. The ocean got him in the end. In 1935, on a night flight over the Bay of Bengal, in a different airplane chasing a different record, Smithy went down into the sea off the coast of Burma and was never found. The Pacific he beat, the Tasman he beat, and the water finally collected. That's the hard part of these old stories. The best of them so often went that way.
But the Southern Cross, the airplane herself, she survived him. And here's the part I love. You can go see her. She's preserved. That actual blue Fokker trimotor in a memorial at the Brisbane Airport in Australia. The real airplane. The one with the salt still in her bones. You can stand there and look at that thick wooden wing and those three little engines and try to imagine four men crammed inside her for 34 hours over the deep blue nothing, passing notes, shooting stars, hand flying through the storms. I think about those old birds a lot. We fly now with a magenta line on a screen and a synthetic voice telling us when to turn. And I'm not knocking it. It keeps people alive. But there was a time when crossing an ocean meant a man in the back with a sextant, doing math by hand in the dark, betting everybody's life that he'd carried the one correctly. And he had. That's not just history, that's the whole reason any of us ever looked up and wanted to go. My thanks today to the records of the aviation historians and the museum folks in Brisbane who've kept the Southern Cross and Smithy's story alive all these years, and to the old accounts the crew themselves left behind. If you want to see photos of that airplane, I'll point you to radiohangar.com and you can look her up. Go find something old and blue in a museum this week. Stand close, smell the oil. Those airplanes remember, even if we forget. This is Tail Dragger Blue Skies, and I'll see you next time.